Welcome to All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News. President Biden delivered his farewell address and issued a warning about the future. Israel and Hamas reached a ceasefire deal. Maybe. Confirmation hearings for President-elect Trump's cabinet have begun. And the inauguration is just days away. Needless to say, there's a lot going on in national politics, and who better to discuss it all with than Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Welcome back to All Sides, Ken.
Good morning, Amy, and congratulations on your appointment.
Thank you. Welcome
on
to
your confirmation hearings, I should say.
I passed through the confirmation hearings. It's
That's
now
right.
All
well,
Sides
you,
with
you
Amy
got, you got soft. I heard you got softball questions, so it doesn't really,
you know. I did. There were a couple of tough senators in there, but so I just listed off a whole lot of topics for us to discuss, and we'll get to them all. I promise we will. But Ken, you are someone who has been watching politics for decades, and while I have you on the show, while I have someone with your knowledge of history, I wanted to start by talking about the passing of former President Carter. Not only was he the longest living U.S. president, his accomplishments and life after the White House became a model for the true meaning of public service. And just with all of your knowledge and history and politics, Ken, I want to know how you will remember President Carter.
Well, that's a great question. And the reason I think it's a great question is, and of course, this is almost like conventional wisdom, but I truly believe this. I was not impressed, shall we say, during Carter's presidency. I think there were a lot of things that while he got right, he also didn't get right. And certainly the hostage situation, comes to mind. The economy comes to mind. The spiraling inflation comes to mind. And so when he was defeated by Ronald Reagan, I think he only won like six or seven states. It was a landslide in 1980. Because the American people said, first of all, he also had that challenge from Ted Kennedy for the nomination that kind of split the Democrats as well. But the point is that it seemed like Carter was somebody who was on his way out during the election, and Ronald Reagan proved it. But in the post-presidency of Jimmy Carter, I can't think of anybody in public life, let alone a former president, who did so much to better the lives of so many Americans, who cared about so many Americans, who cared about the homeless and the poor and the disadvantaged. And when I think of so many people in politics who just basically what they want to do after they leave office is just to enrich themselves and fill their pockets, Jimmy Carter was a true humanitarian. So yes, I mean, there was nothing. I mean, look, the guy was 100 years old, and yet, there was a certain sadness, and I think part of the sadness is one, he had just an amazing, illustrious post-presidency that people could only dream of having, and two, I guess compared to the political situation that we're going through right now, Jimmy Carter just represented a time when there was a word called decency that we don't see today, and I think that's part of the mourning, the M-O-U-R-N, mourning, we felt following his passing.
Much has been made about his funeral. It's one of those rare occasions when it brought five living presidents, as well as it also brought together the two women who were the Democratic presidential nominees who lost to Donald Trump. Did you find the optics of the funeral awkward, entertaining? What did you find about it?
Fascinating. I mean, I don't know about awkward. I mean, to see Mike Pence, Donald Trump's former vice president, stand up and give Donald Trump a handshake. And Donald Trump was the guy who said, go ahead, you're going to hang Mike Pence? Let's do it. So it was very interesting. It was interesting that Karen Pence, Mike Pence's wife, refused to get up when Donald Trump was there, shaking hands. It was very interesting when George and Laura Bush came in, that George W. Bush went straight to Barack Obama, gave him a playful pat on the stomach, but ignored Donald Trump completely. I mean, Donald Trump will never be part of the club. And that's because basically he's part of his campaign was to ridicule and denigrate the club, because Donald Trump is different and he's a new politics, which is true. But it was just very interesting to see that, the buddy-buddy you always think of with presidents Just didn't, happen during the Carter funeral. Plus the fact that I also noticed it was kind of interesting that there seemed to be a little tension between Jill Biden and Kamala Harris. And I don't know if that's a media creation or not, but I think, I mean, the story suggests that Jill Biden wanted Joe Biden to run, and of course Joe Biden was forced out, one, because of such a horrific debate performance against Donald Trump in June that suggested that he was not going to win, and he was not going to win. So there's a lot of tensions within the Democratic Party, and the famous picture of Kamala Harris looking back as Donald Trump and Barack Obama were involved in a seemingly happy conversation. There were a lot of things to watch, but we were there to honor and celebrate Jimmy Carter, and these are all subtexts, but it was kind of fun to watch.
And this is something I didn't know, or I guess didn't realize, that the tradition is when a former president dies, flags are flown at half staff for 30 days. I guess I maybe I just missed that. I didn't know that, but now I know it because they're not going to fly at 30 days. Can you tell us about that?
Well, this is vintage Republican Party. This is not the Republican Party of any recent past. This is Donald Trump's Republican Party, and Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, said that even though, yes, we are the flag is at half mast for Jimmy Carter, it will be raised full for Donald Trump's inauguration on the 20th, which is just, I mean, it's because it's Donald Trump, and how could you be having the flag at half mast when we're celebrating the greatest thing that's ever happened in mankind history, which is the re-election of Donald Trump. So Mike Johnson did what Donald Trump told him to do, and that is to raise the flag. It's just, I believe, it's just at the Capitol that the flag, because Mike Johnson has no say on the rest of the country, whether the flag should be at half staff or not, but at least in the Capitol, during the inauguration, the flag will be full and flying full.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin. And now we'll move on to more recent events. President Biden delivered his farewell address last night. After 50 years in politics, he said goodbye. He had inspiring words, but he also issued a warning.
I want to warn the country of some things that give me great concern. This is a dangerous concentration, and that's a dangerous concentration of power in the hands of a very few ultra-wealthy people. The dangerous consequences if their abuse of power is left unchecked. Today, an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy, our basic rights and freedoms, and a fair shot for everyone to get ahead.
Ken, have you ever heard a farewell address come with such a direct warning?
Well, everybody's mind immediately went back to Dwight Eisenhower in 1961 when he talked about the military-industrial complex, as he was leaving the presidency after 8 years. And a lot, I think President Biden even referred to Ike in his speech last night. So that's the closest I've ever seen to a president offering a warning to the future. And Biden was pretty dramatic is not the right word, but he was insistent that there is a risk, there is a danger up ahead with the ultra wealthy, with the oligarchy, with the control of the media, things like that, the falling apart of the media, the control of the media that Donald Trump would like to continue in a second term. So there were a lot of warnings out there, and it was nice and everything, but then at the same time, I keep thinking of the Justice Department of Joe Biden, who waited, which waited, in my view, waited far too long and too late to prosecute the cases, plural, against Donald Trump. And of course, Donald Trump was able to wait out the game. And by the time the Justice Department was ready to go through all these trials and stuff, lo and behold, he was elected president, and that kind of ended so much of the cases against Donald Trump. So I kind of think that the warnings were apt, the warnings were important, but at the same time, I think the Joe Biden and his administration could have done a stronger, better, more efficient job of warning the country about rising totalitarianism in this country, rising hate in this country. And of course, he's leaving with so much of this basically untaken care of, and with the possibility of it even getting worse. So kudos to Biden. He said the right things. Maybe perhaps he should have said them earlier, but it was clear who he was talking about, what he was talking about. And maybe it would be a very good story for maybe one day, and it will be forgotten by the time Donald Trump raises his hand on the 20th.
And Biden also spent a lot of time in his speech last night painting a picture of America using a lot of Statue of Liberty imagery. What did you think of that sentiment?
Well, I mean, I think that was basically what Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party was trying to say, that liberty is precious, it is dear, it is at risk. Some of the things that Donald Trump was talking about during the campaign was alarming to many people who believe in, who try to ward off the fear of authoritarianism. Donald Trump made the joke that I'll only be a dictator on day one, but there are a lot of things he's been talking about retribution and revenge and deportation and arresting of journalists and lawmakers, people who were part of the January 6th committee, and Liz Cheney and Dr. Fauci. There were so many things that frightened so many people. I mean, you think of Nixon and the enemies list. I don't think there's anything in our history that has ever come as close to basically encroaching authoritarianism as we're possibly approaching with this kind of new administration. And I think there's a big fear in the Democratic Party, and they tried to make the case, and everybody said, well, Kamala Harris didn't really do a good job, and she should have separated herself more from Joe Biden and blah, blah, blah. But I think she and the Democrats made the case as well as they could. And it was clear that the American people, not an overwhelming majority, but certainly more than Kamala Harris got, the people wanted Donald Trump, and they liked what he represented, and they didn't like the fact that there was an encroachment and a leakage in the border, and it seemed like people were just coming in, and there was no, it was a porous border. And they said, the crime is up and the price of eggs is up. And, I mean, there were no specifics that Trump was offering. There was no guarantee that he would change anything. But people just didn't like the status quo, and they refused to look at the big picture, which was the future of democracy. And I think Biden tried to talk about that last night. The Democrats tried to talk about it during the campaign, and it basically fell on deaf ears.
Earlier, we were talking about President Carter, and unlike the Iran hostage crisis during Carter's time in office, President Biden's administration worked on negotiating the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas. Now, in the time he gave his speech last night and this morning, it may have fallen apart a little bit. We will see. But did you think that this would happen? Do you think that this will be something that Biden will be remembered for if it happens on Sunday?
Well, from everything I've read and everything I've seemed to understand about this, both, and this is almost an amazing thing to see, but say, but both Joe Biden and Donald Trump take credit and perhaps deserve to take credit for what happened. Because, I mean, basically, Joe Biden really had no sway with the Israelis. Netanyahu was basically waiting out the war, or certainly waiting out until the election was over, knowing that he'd get a better deal from Donald Trump, who basically said, you could wipe Gaza off the face of the earth and I wouldn't care. I mean, he didn't say those exact words, but that was an effect of what he said. And the only thing that Biden could have done, maybe, was to threaten Netanyahu by withholding U.S. aid. And in an election year, you just can't do that. You don't do that with a large Jewish vote, knowing that the Democrats were split over Israel, whether that Biden was too tough or too soft on Israel. And so Biden seemed to be in a, you know, in a pickle. But the fact that his negotiators have been working for months, working with both with the Palestinians and you know the people in Gaza and the Israelis, and it's a great success. I mean, and of course Donald Trump, who desperately wants to be considered for the Nobel Peace Prize, he basically said, "Look, I want this finished. I want this done. I want this over by the time I take office." Now, as you say, there are some complications, and maybe it might fall apart. But the fact is that I think that Donald Trump's victory did tell the Palestinians that they're not going to get any deal, any better deal under Donald Trump, and maybe we should succumb to peace negotiations now. So I think both sides, for different reasons, deservedly take credit for this. And just like with the situation in Northern Ireland, I never thought I would live to see a peace deal there. And I'm still not going to jump the gun and say everything's okay with Israel and Palestine. But I think it's just a very good and important start, especially with a tinderbox like we see in the Middle East.
I find the timing very interesting because it's supposed to go into effect on Sunday, Biden's last day in office. Trump officially becomes president at noon on Monday, but now there's a delay. I
It
feel like,
reminds, yeah, it reminds me a little bit of, remember when the hostages were released, they waited until Jimmy Carter was last day as president, and Ronald Reagan was sworn in. Once Ronald Reagan was sworn in on January 20th, 1981, then the hostages were released. So it's just,
so the Reagan
you know,
administration can say, we freed the hostages.
that's exactly right, and to this day, that's what conventional wisdom says.
And maybe it'll be similar. We'll have to see what happens at noon on Monday.
Yeah.
Coming up, we're going to continue to talk about national politics with Ken Rudin. We will discuss a few confirmation hearings. That is When All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. With the new Congress having been sworn in, confirmation hearings for President Trump's cabinet picks have begun. Proposed Secretary of Defense and former Fox News anchor Pete Hegseth began his hearing on Tuesday and is facing tough questions about his past conduct and his fitness for the role. Still with us is the host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Thanks for being here, Ken.
My pleasure. A lot to talk about.
Yes. There were some tense moments in the confirmation hearing for Hegseth. Senator Tim Kaine had a somewhat aggressive back and forth with Hegseth. Let's listen.
But you acknowledge,
and
you,
it was
but you acknowledge that you cheated on your wife and that you cheated on the woman by whom you had just fathered a child. You have admitted that.
I will allow your words to speak for themselves.
You're not retracting that today. That's good. I assume that in each of your weddings, you've pledged to be faithful to your wife. You've taken an oath to do that, haven't you?
Senator, as I've acknowledged to everyone in this committee, not a perfect person, not claiming to
be. But no, I just asked a simple question. You've taken an oath, like you would take an oath to be Secretary of Defense in all of your weddings, to be faithful to your wife. Is that correct?
I have failed in things in my life, and thankfully I'm redeemed by my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
So, Ken, pretty much the whole hearing was like that if a Democrat was asking questions, where it was just a back and forth with no answers. Did this moment with Tim Kaine stand out to you?
No. And the reason it didn't is because basically the real confrontation I was awaiting, or at least the back and forth I was waiting, was with Joni Ernst, the Republican senator from Iowa, who's a combat veteran who was sexually assaulted. And she had been very critical of Hegseth's nomination when it was first made. But by the time the hearings began, she did. I mean, she was so full of softball questions and nothing questioning his fitness. And, you know, it's one thing to talk about marital infidelities. I mean, if we're going to, you know, if we're going to criticize Pete Hegseth, well, I mean, Donald Trump apparently broke those vows as well. So when on Tuesday, you know, on the 20th, when Donald Trump is asking, do you solemnly swear? Well, what does that mean anymore? I mean, there are so many things that he has sworn to uphold and sworn to as the truth, and if not, has not been the truth. So I don't know what that question means anymore. And matter of fact, Mark Wayne Mullen, the Republican senator from Oklahoma, response to Tim Kaine's questions, he said, well, how many of us are so perfect? How many of us haven't had affairs? Which is really remarkable endorsement of the U.S. Senate. Mm. And it reminds me, you know, I love, of course, I love political history. And back in 1989, when the first President Bush named former Senator John Tower to be Secretary of Defense, the argument against Tower was that he was a drunk and he was a womanizer. And, you know, it was very interesting to see all these drunk and womanizing senators criticizing him for his behavior. And ultimately, he was rejected by a Democratic Senate. This is a Republican Senate. Boy, you know, if anybody wants to know how important it is, what party controls the Senate, the Hegseth hearings is exactly right. But there's been a lot of stories that there's been an unbelievable amount of pressure on Joni Ernst and other Republicans that you got to stay strong to the party. You know, the Republicans still have an advantage, and they can only afford to lose two or three at most in the confirmation hearings, considering the fact that all the Democrats are likely to vote against him. But I mean, when you think of all the things when he's shown up, Hegseth allegedly showed up drunk for either at Fox or at meetings or things like that, and he says, I'll stop drinking when I'm on the job. I mean, my God, what a promise that is.
I know. I can't wait until we have the first picture of him holding a drink at an event, right?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Or, you know, so between, I mean, look, the marital things, but his also his comments about women in combat, that they don't belong in combat, that I don't like to see women in the military. And then he said, oh, I've changed my mind, even though less than a month ago he gave an interview where he still said that women should not be in the armed services. So there's so many things that make this, I mean, you know, Matt Gaetz maybe, you know, Matt Gaetz has to rival him as the most unbelievable galling nominations in cabinet history. I can't remember anyone close to this. I mean, there are certain qualifications usually when a nominee is brought forward, but I can't think of any qualification for Pete Hegseth other than the fact that Donald Trump is insisting on him. And there was once upon a time when the Hegseth nomination seemed to be in real trouble, and Trump was allegedly looking at like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and others as a possible replacement. But then there was this multi-million dollar campaign to focus on these wavering Republican senators not to break ranks. And Joni Ernst, for example, is up for re-election in 2026. And you know that had she, you know, stuck to her guns and said, this is unacceptable behavior, she would have been met with a primary challenge in 26. So my only point is that there is no opposition on the Republican side, just like with almost everything with Donald Trump, because they know that their political future is in jeopardy if they dare cross, you know, the Donald on any kind of thing like this, especially an important thing like this, and their political career, they feel may not be worth sacrificing, you know, it for a vote against Pete Hegseth. Democrats are frustrated. But some of the questions that I heard, Tim Sheehy, the new senator from Montana, he's the one who beat John Tester. One of his questions were, how many push-ups can you do? I mean, like I'm watching Seinfeld or Mad Magazine. It's just like, you can't even make this stuff up. But this is basically, you know, welcome to the world. So just like presidential debates, I don't think matters anymore. I mean, think of it. All the Republicans who would debate without Donald Trump made no difference. Kamala Harris, I thought, wiped the floor with Donald Trump in the debate, makes no difference. confirmation hearings makes no difference because the Democrats can ask all the questions about marital infidelity and drinking on the job and sexual discrimination against women and things like that. And yet it's like a done deal. Like the deal is done. And it's just, I've never seen anything like it. Once upon a time, confirmation hearings mattered. You think of Clarence Thomas, you think of John Tower, you think of whether they win or they lose. Serious things are being discussed, but right now it seems like it's all a show and just let's just move on because Donald Trump needs his people in power.
I also wonder if this term for President Trump is going to be similar to the last term, because I felt like after about a year, year and a half, cabinet members were getting fired or resigning left and right, and all of the names kept changing.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. But back then, a lot of his early cabinet picks, they were establishment figures. They were not loyal to Trump. They were loyal to the Constitution for the most part. Not all of them, but for the most part. Whereas now, Donald Trump is not going to make the same mistake. He's picking some.
He's picking his people this time instead of people recommended to him.
Kash Patel, the head of the FBI. Oh my God! I mean, bring back J. Edgar Hoover for moderation. This is a guy who has promised to go after Trump's enemies, and the thought of the FBI being in those hands is just, it's beyond. But welcome to politics, 2025.
Before we talk a little bit about previewing the inauguration, Ken, I wanted to discuss just for a moment the wildfires in California. They're becoming politicized now, with some members of the GOP saying that there will be strings attached to aid given to California. This could be setting a dangerous precedent for future fire victims, floods, hurricanes, things like that.
It's not even a precedent because, you know, we've seen in the past, like when there were terrible, you know, God-made tragedies, you know, weather tragedies in the South, for example, Democrats never suggested, let's hold up aid to Mississippi or Louisiana because of politics. But we saw not only with the storms in New Jersey years ago, and a lot of Democrats didn't want to vote for them because it was a blue state, to hear Donald Trump talk about Gavin Newsom. I mean, that's what he called him. And this is the next president of the United States blaming the fires on Joe Biden and Gavin Newsom instead of Newsom, the governor of California. Mm-hmm. And that's just beyond. And then the Republicans saying, well, sure, we'll give you aid, but it has to be, written off, or at least, maybe there's some concessions or things that we need to do if you're going to get this money, as if it's a deal, as if the horrific photos and the videos of what has happened in California isn't enough to open up everybody's checkbook and wallet to somehow save what's left of this area. But it's the fact that they're playing politics with life and death is just, I mean, how many times, Amy, on your show, I'm going to talk about heartbreaking and unprecedented. But it is heartbreaking and unprecedented that this is just about politics, and nobody seems to be, nobody seems to be outraged about it. It's just us. Oh well, that's what the Republicans are doing.
You'd be outraged if it happens to you, but not if it's someone else.
Well, look at the past when there was Texas or Louisiana or Mississippi, Democrats said, of course, these people are suffering. Of course, we're not going to put conditions on aid. But that's not what we're seeing in California. And that's just shameful.
We're talking politics with the political junkie Ken Rudin. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And the inauguration of President Trump for his second term is Monday. And President Trump has expressed concerns about security at the event. Officials are already beginning to prepare for crowds. You know, I heard a story this morning on NPR that the National Park Service has done away with their crowd counting. They have decided not to count crowds anymore. I wonder why.
Well, I do know that Donald Trump's first inaugural was the biggest crowd in human history. It was bigger than, Martin Luther King's speech on the Mall. It was Look, I'm kidding, of course, but I mean, Trump is obsessed with numbers and how many people, you know, attend the things. And it was fun to watch Kamala Harris rib him and tease him and mock him, actually, during the debate, saying about, you know, how it, about his obsession to have crowds and things like that.
The story this morning said the National Park Service decided that they would rather hire another park ranger to run a program than deal with this counting thing again.
So. Exactly. And why would you want Donald Trump, you know, lambasting the Bureau and the services because he doesn't like the numbers that they came up with? It's not even worth it.
So Trump has invited some of the wealthiest individuals in the U.S. to the inauguration, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, all of whom donated to his inauguration fund. What tone do you expect President Trump to strike in his inaugural speech?
That's a good question, because I was pretty stunned at his speech in 2017 when he basically said that the United States, usually during an inauguration, there's uplifting words, and I think of Kennedy, and I think of Nixon, and I think of Obama, and I think of Clinton, and I think of Reagan. They were uplifting messages, that, you know, celebrating the peaceful transfer of power and things like that. But Trump was so negative in 2017 about what a cesspool the United States was, and how, you know, it was falling apart, and only he could save it. I don't know what to expect, but it's interesting, you know, when you mentioned the Zuckerbergs and people like that, and Bezos and things like that, and then you think of what's happened to the media in this country, which is a little separate subject from the inauguration, but the fact that the Bezos and Zuckerberg, they donated $1 million to the inauguration, and everybody is just so terrified of what Donald Trump could do to them or their businesses or their livelihoods or their careers that they'd rather be on their side rather than taking a risk and incurring Donald Trump's wrath. And
oh my God. Here, I'll give you a different question. So former Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, who will now be sworn in as vice president, he joked that he wanted to skip the inauguration to attend the Ohio State National Championship football game. But obviously, I mean, it was obvious he was joking, but I would doubt that he would miss his own inauguration.
But think of what happened in 2021. The fact that Donald Trump and Melania Trump refused to show up to Joe Biden's inauguration. Which is amazing. And now that Michelle Obama is not showing up, on the 20th this year, so many people are criticizing him. Oh, what's wrong with you? I mean, that's protocol. And what kind of a first lady are you? And I'm saying,
you pick and choose your protocol, I guess.
Exactly right. And by the way, speaking of Vance, I don't know if we have time to talk about it, but it's very interesting. The behind the scenes going on, who will replace him in the Senate? Because now it seems like Trump is angling for Vivek Ramaswamy.
Vivek Ramaswamy said in November, when Trump asked him to be on the government the government efficiency committee, he pulled his name out from being considered to the Senate. So then Mike DeWine went on with picking someone, and everyone around here thinks it was going to be Lieutenant Governor John Husted getting the Senate pick. But now, as of yesterday, suddenly Vivek Ramaswamy's name's back in there.
Right. I still think it's going to be Husted. I still think that it could be Jane Timken. I don't think, if memory serves, I don't think Ohio has ever had an elected female senator.
Correct.
But DeWine has never been a yes man to Donald Trump. Not as bad as John Kasich, but the fact is, you know, he has shown independence. So just like with Florida,
I was going to say, except that DeWine and Husted went to Mar-a-Lago and met with Trump. So DeWine is not a yes man to Trump, but it did seem like he went and asked permission.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it could be seen that way, but I think he also wanted to make the way I saw it is that he wanted to make the case for Husted. And I think that's still going to be the case. But, you know, the same thing is going on in Florida, when once upon a time, Donald Trump was pushing for his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, you know, the former RNC vice chair or co-chair, to replace Marco Rubio, who's going to be the next Secretary of State, and Governor DeSantis clearly wanted somebody else. So sometimes governors can actually have independence, where unlike senators who basically are more involved and more tied to Trump's whims than governors would be.
Governor DeWine promised to announce who Ohio's next senator will be this week. And, you know, we're already at Thursday and he hasn't. So we're not sure.
I mean, obviously it has to be done before the 20th. Vance resigned his Senate seat, I think, last Friday. So it's an open seat, vacant seat. And as you well remember, the last senator appointed to fill a vacancy in Ohio?
You're quizzing me? I don't know.
It was Howard Metzenbaum when William Saxby resigned to become Nixon's attorney general. Governor Gilligan appointed Howard Metzenbaum, and then Metzenbaum went on to lose to John Glenn in the primary.
I would have missed the double jeopardy on that one. Sorry.
But you have to make sure it's in the form of a question.
Got it. Coming up, we're going to continue to talk about national politics with Ken Rudin, the host of the Political Junkie podcast. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. In the weeks leading up to his inauguration, President Trump has proposed a number of potential expansions to American territory. Ideas such as purchasing Greenland and reclaiming the Panama Canal, or the annexation of Canada to become the 51st state, have put American allies on edge as they prepare for another Trump term. We're talking about national politics with the host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Thanks again for being here, Ken.
Oh my God, that list you just said.
I'm going to make you talk about each one. No, I'm kidding.
Know whether to laugh or cry.
Yeah. So President Trump talked about the potential of Canada becoming the 51st state, acquiring Greenland. Does this surprise you? Does anything surprise you anymore?
Does anything surprise me? That's a better question. Yes. And matter of fact, yes, that's the surprising thing, the most surprising thing of all, that given everything that Donald Trump has said and done over in the last, you know, since he came down that escalator at Trump Towers, you think that we're immune to being surprised. And yet, I mean, Greenland, I mean, basically Canada, the Panama Canal, the Gulf of America. I mean, it's not the Gulf of Mexico, it's the Gulf of America. I don't know what it is, if it's to divert attention away from other serious things like the Jack Smith report that he was trying to block from coming out. Even Eileen Cannon, his protector in Florida, the judge in Florida, said that, you know, it should be released. But I don't know if it's to detract or distract from other things, but it's just wild. And yet the rest of the world doesn't really know how to deal with it. Are they amused? Are they ignoring it? Are they scared? I have a friend from Denmark who just wrote me today that they're terrified about Trump's designs on Greenland, only because, I mean, this, you know, it's not Trump's to have. Mm-hmm. It's like a little child. He sees this shiny thing in front of him and he wants it and he has to have it. And he said he would even consider using force. Now, that is just...
Well, that's a little scary, yeah.
Well, yes, a little scary. I mean, it's very scary. Oh, as opposed to deporting half the country, you know, the thousands of people from the country You know, the attacks on the journalists and people like that. But you know something, we're not going to be bored in the next 4 years. I'm hoping that we do have future elections. I do hope that there really will be an off-year election in 2026 and a presidential election in 2028. Do I think that Donald Trump is going to run again? I don't know. I mean, you know, you talk about what surprises you anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, constitutionally, he can't run for a third term, but so what? Mm-hmm. You know, everything is so what, you know, but the law says you can't do that. So what? So
we'll change the law, change the Constitution,
exactly.
Right? Right. So there's other confirmation hearings happening. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, he's Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, which he'll play an important role in this whole Greenland thing, I guess.
And it's interesting because he's one of the people who really supported the war against Ukraine. We don't know what's going to happen to Ukraine mm-hmm. under Trump administration. The war is not going well for them, but it never was going well for them. And, you know, while Biden was hemming and hawing about what kind of weapons to sell them, I mean, when he started to get more aggressive with the weaponry, it was almost like too late because Trump is going to cut off the spigot, you know, starting on the 20th. So there are so many things I could think that Joe Biden could have done and failed to do in during his term of office. And he only has a few days. Does he pardon? Does he protect, you know, Jack Smith and Liz Cheney and Dr. Fauci, people that Trump said, you know, threatening with prison? Does he?
I feel like I should have started at the beginning keeping a tally of your heavy size, Ken, because I've
No, you know something. I mean, I live and breathe politics. I love campaigns and
hasn't Trump made it more fun, more interesting to talk about politics?
Let me think for a second. No.
All right, there you go. It's not fun. Not fun. But Marco Rubio, he is poised to be one that he's well liked. It's expected he might, you know, it might not be that all the Democrats vote against everyone. He might actually get a bipartisan vote.
Yeah, it was certainly. I mean, usually that's the case when it's a former senator, and that reminds me of course, the John Tower nomination in 1989, when some Democrats did vote for him, and one Republican, Nancy Kassenbaum, voted against him. But for the most part, they give the benefit of the doubt to a senator. But Marco Rubio is not a controversial nominee. Even, you know, Pam Bondi, even given her role on January 6th and the things she said about whether Donald Trump is, you know, whether Joe Biden was actually elected in 2020, given all those controversial comments, she also is going to probably sail through. It's the Cash Patels, it's the Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence. And of course, Hegseth, who is probably going to go through, and they're just remarkable that nobody seems to say that this is wrong. I mean, it's bizarre, but it's also wrong.
We should say Pam Bondi is the nominee for Attorney General, and she's the person who replaced
Matt. Did I say her name wrong?
No. I'm just explaining who she is. She's the nominee for Attorney General, but she replaced Matt Gaetz. Congressman Matt Gaetz stepped down from the nomination.
Nobody can replace Matt Gaetz.
Of course.
Matt Gaetz is now talking about running for governor of Florida. And yet you listen to the House report about his drugs and sex stories. And he's the front runner for governor of Florida.
There's one other nominee I wanted to ask you about because I'm going to steal a joke that I heard on Morning Edition. So former Congressman Sean Duffy is in that group. He's Trump's nominee for transportation secretary.
Right, from Wisconsin.
Yes.
Right.
And he seems to be well-liked. And
yes,
he also is an alumni of the MTV reality series Road Rules. And so he will be doing the rules of the road as transportation secretary.
Ooh,
I like that. You can borrow that. That wasn't mine. That's from Morning Edition.
No, I don't have jokes anymore. I just have size.
Yes. So
you know how Al Gore started that during the debate when every time George W. Bush would say something, Al Gore would do his famous sigh like.
Now it's the Ken Rudin sigh.
That's right. Yes. Exactly. And we always thought that size don't matter. I don't know.
Well, Pete Buttigieg has done a lot as Secretary of Transportation. Do you think that Sean Duffy will continue it? Do you think that maybe that's one of the areas? I haven't really heard Trump, you know, in his first 100 days in office speeches, he doesn't really mention, you know, roads and planes and trains and automobiles.
No, but there are some good people there. I mean, I just like Dave Weldon of Florida. You know, there are some people who have good reputations when they were in office, have good relationships with the lawmakers across the aisle, and he and Sean Duffy and people like that, I think, could, you know, give the cabinet a good name. It's just that it's the more outlandish nominations that just scare me the most.
Earlier, we were talking about, you know, J.D. Vance is no longer Ohio's senator. We have a brand new senator, Bernie Moreno, and then we're going to have another brand new senator, whoever Governor DeWine picks today or tomorrow. What do you think is what does that mean for Ohio to have two brand new senators instead of having the seniority?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know what seniority means anymore. I mean, Barack Obama was in the Senate for 15 minutes and he was running for president. On the other hand, Joe Biden was in the Senate for 150 years and, you know, and he had the seniority. So I don't know. I think it really doesn't matter. Look, J.D. Vance, my goodness, he was elected vice president. He was elected to the Senate with basically no experience other than writing a bestseller, and now he's going to be vice president. So I don't know what it means as far as seniority, but I think Ohio certainly is not going to be ignored. You have somebody, they knocked off Sherrod Brown, that was Bernie Moreno. You have a vice president from Ohio. I think Ohio, you know, could be very significant, play a significant role in the Trump administration as far as opportunities and infrastructure and things like that. So we'll see what happens.
We did receive an email from Pam. She wants to know what you think about Trump's proposed tariffs and what it will do to the cost of consumer goods.
Well, there's no question that they will. Everything will cost much more with the tariffs. But I've never seen tariffs used the way Trump has used it, basically to oust, you know, Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada. I mean, basically, he's threatened them with such, you know, punishing tariffs that a lot of people might not even want to run for office in Canada because they just fear what Trump is going to do to them. But I've never seen tariffs used in such an overt political way, not only to force concessions economically, but to make political attacks and make political changes because of that threat. It's just remarkable. But as far as your question about whether things will cost more, yeah, cost more. Yes, they will. And the real question is whether the tariffs are just a bluff or partly a bluff. But Trump has said from the beginning, even before he was a candidate for president, that so many countries are taking advantage of the U.S. and they should be punished with the bigger tariffs.
So looking ahead to Monday when the inauguration happens, Trump made a lot of promises of what he's going to do in his first 100 days. He made even more promises of what he's going to do in the first 24 hours. What's one or two you think will actually happen?
Well, again, we'll see. I'd like to see the vote about Kesh Patel and for the FBI. But assuming this administration is going to, you know, be exactly the way Trump wanted, I'm just going to look at the things he promised most, and that is the deportations, the roundups, and things like that, the threats against the press. This he has an opportunity to be a really, he could change a lot of things that went wrong. There were a lot of things that Joe Biden didn't take care of, and such as the border, and he realized it too late, and that also cost him. I think there's a feeling in this country that the immigration situation has gotten out of hand. So people will be interested to watch that. But it's the retribution and the revenge that worry me the most. And we'll just see how much, again, like I said, is a bluff or is really a reality.
We have been talking about national politics this hour with Ken Rudin. He's the host of the Political Junkie podcast. Thank you for being here today, Ken.
Do I have time for another sigh?
Yes. Oh, there it is. All right. It'll be okay, Ken. We'll be all right, right?
Amy, again, congratulations on your job.
Thank you. Thank you. You've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.